things.
On the air at 91.5 WMFO. On the web at WMFO.org.
Leave room for your growth tomorrow.
Halfway across Alabama, well, a hound broke down and left us all stranded in downtown. the terminal gate. Sweet low chariot, calm down, easy taxi to the terminal zone. Cut your engines and cool your wings and let me make it to the telephone. Los Angeles, you're in Norfolk, Virginia, tied 104-1009. Telephone's back home, this is the promised land, called and the poor boy's on the line. He would sit us at the terminal gate. A swing low chariot, come down, ease a taxi to the terminal zone. Cut your engines and cool your wings and let me make it to the telephone. Los Angeles, you may know for Virginia side, what a 1409. When the folks back home, this is the promised land, calling and the poor boys on.
This is Dan Dennett, and you are tuned into WMFO in Medford. 91.5 FM, Tufts Educational Radio.
Oh, destiny. Thank you. So when you get to the corner of Smith and Orchard, you're going to want to take a
left.
You
are not going to
Then what you're
going to
do is turn onto Marcy
and Brett
Avenue.
Just broke up.
And go past
and
the first three lights and then take
it.
The next left.
I don't really
then drive
think
five
she's
more
happy,
blocks,
but
and you should be
who
there.
Who am I to judge, right?
Park anyway. On the right.
That's what I heard last night. I'll see you later tonight.
It's hard to concentrate on two things at once, like texting and driving. Stop the text, stop the wrecks. How will you stop texting and driving? Tell us at stoptextstoprex.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
So when you get to the corner of Smith and Orchard, you're going to want to take a
you
left.
You are not going to
Then what you're
going to
do is turn onto Marcy
and Brett
Avenue.
Just broke up.
And go past
and
the first three lights and then take the next left.
I don't really
drive
think
five
she's
more
happy,
blocks,
but
and you should be
who
there.
Who am I to judge, right?
Park
anyway,
on the right.
That's
I'll
what
see
I
you
heard
later
last
tonight.
It's hard to concentrate on two things at once, like texting and driving. Stop the text, stop the wrecks. How will you stop texting and driving? Tell us at stoptextstoprex.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Sure, humans can be a little weird at times, but take it from me, I'm a dog. And a person is about the best thing that can happen to a shelter pet. So if you want to learn how you can be that person, get down to your local pet shelter or visit theshelterpetproject.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
And good afternoon. Chuck Morse here, Chuck Morse Radio at WMFO, Tufts Freeform Radio in Medford, Somerville. You're welcome to join the program, 855-915-9636, 855-915-9636. And a welcome aboard as I continue this great experiment, if you will. This my goal being to develop a radio program right here at Tufts University and eventually at other universities by syndicating the show that challenges so-called political correctness, if you will, that examines some of the ideas that are being promulgated on campus and does so with a critical eye. I am broadcasting here at WMFO, but I'm not a student broadcaster. I'm a community broadcaster. And so I bring somewhat of the eye of an outsider onto the college campus with the hope that by reaching the college campus here at Tufts University, which is one of America's preeminent colleges, I am going to be able to engage in discourse, hopefully friendly and constructive discourse, with people who are going to be in positions in the future of influence in these United States, whether it be in politics, business, culture, academia, economy, whatever. And so in that spirit, I invite you to come on down. 855-915-9636 is the number. 855-915-9636. And let me just set up my Facebook. I'm going live here also. And there we go. Go live. And there it is, live on Facebook. If you want to see the show and listen to it simultaneously, you can go to my Facebook page, that being Chuck Morse or Boston Uberman. I do drive Uber. I love Uber. It's one of the many things I do. And you can see the show live. But in the meantime, I'm here live at the Tufts University WMFO studio. An excellent studio, by the way. And I'm holding fort, so come on down. What's on your mind this afternoon? 855-915-9636. 855-915-9636. Merry Christmas to you and your family and yours. Merry Christmas to the students at Tufts and beyond. And I do feel good about saying Merry Christmas because that has been, in a subtle way, established by our new president-elect who can influence the culture in many ways when he wishes Americans a Merry Christmas. It's okay to say Christmas again, right? I mean, for a while we had to use euphemisms like holidays. I mean, which holiday are we talking about? We're talking about Christmas. Or you could say Happy Hanukkah, I suppose, or Happy Kwanzaa. But the actual legal holiday in the United States is Christmas. It was recognized as such by an executive order in 1870 that was signed by President Ulysses S. Grant. So it is perfectly legal and appropriate and lawful, if you will, to say Merry Christmas. And so Merry Christmas. It's kind of, I think it's a good idea to support the spirit of Christmas, and I'm saying this as, by the way, someone who doesn't happen to be Christian, because I support, in the small C sense, the Christian heritage of this country. I think that this is a, quote, Christian nation with a small c. I think that Christianity and the principles that it represents are responsible for creating this society, for creating the principles by which we live. And I honor that. I honor our Christian heritage. And so I have no problem saying Merry Christmas, not because I believe in the Christian, you know, view of Jesus as Christ. That's a religious question. That's up to the individual, even though I support that belief. I'm saying it more out of the spirit that regardless of whether one believes in the divinity of Jesus, that's, again, a theological question. I don't think there's any question that the ministry of Jesus is responsible for the United States. I think that's a fact of history. That the ministry of Jesus, who took forth into the world the teachings, the moral and ethical precepts of what Judaism calls the Torah, that it took these forth into the world, in that sense, that ministry was, in the real sense, progressive, and it led to the European civilization, which eventually gave birth to the American civilization. And so I, as an American, honor that and have no problem saying that I do so when I say Merry Christmas. That's what I mean. I'm grateful for the ministry of Jesus, that it led to the freedoms by which I enjoy. I also like the message of Christmas. Peace on earth, goodwill to men. To me, it has a universal theme, one that I embrace wholeheartedly. And I also like, and I know this has come under criticism, but I happen to like the commercialism of Christmas. I like the idea of gift giving and receiving. I like the fact that American industry and businesses can have a reap rewards, material rewards from Christmas. That's good. I think that it's good for the economy in the sense that it helps families come together and exchange gifts, and it's good for the economy as a whole because it results in a lot of transactions, which keep people employed and help people accumulate some wealth. And those things are good. Those things are positive. Which is why I think that we are entering, and I'm grateful that we are, just looking at my Facebook page here, I'm grateful that we are entering into the age of Trump. And I hope that people are reconciling themselves to that, at least, if not celebrating it like I do. I believe that Donald J. Trump is a revolutionary figure. He is coming around at a time, and the reaction to him is as such that it is unprecedented in my lifetime. And I'm old enough to remember. I mean, I'm a lot older than you, the listener, most likely. And I've gotten into this in past programs, but I think it might be worth recapping it. And the reason that Donald Trump is such a revolutionary figure, one that we should embrace Whether we agree with the particulars of his administration or not is perfectly fine. But the spirit of what he represents and why people voted for him is something that I think all Americans should embrace. Again, that doesn't mean you have to agree. I mean, we have loyal opposition, but we should embrace the principles or the principle that he ran on. And it's bigger than him as a person. And that principle is putting America first. That is a revolutionary idea. That also happens to be the very idea that was the predominant one embraced not only by our founding generation, but by every generation since. Because it is a sensible idea. It is a logical idea. It is an idea that stands to reason. Of course we're going to put America first. You know, people may even say that to me scornfully. What are you talking about? Sure. Why is that so important? Well, because shockingly as it may seem to some, but not to many, our administration, our establishment, if you will, and when I say establishment, I mean that generically, because I include in that a lot of Republicans as well as Democrats, even some conservatives. They have increasingly not put America first in recent decades, if not in this past century. They have put the interests of world order first. They have wanted to sublimate America to a growing world order. And that is an idea that not only is illogical and, quite frankly, insane, but it's evil. Let's take a look at that, all right? I mean, I know I'm sounding, maybe I'm breaking things down simplistically here, but the fact is that when you as an individual get through your day, you're doing so because you are putting yourself first. Everyone does. It's normal. It's natural. It's good, actually. You have to be restrained in your efforts to put yourself first by a system of law and order, by social pressure, by moral and ethical codes, by faith, if you will. I mean, whether you have whatever your faith may be. But nevertheless, in that context, you as an individual put yourself first over anyone else. Putting yourself first may be putting your child first, but that's putting yourself first also, or your wife or your husband first, or your family first. But in a sense, you're putting yourself first when you do that because that's a great value to you. Generally speaking, the traditional pecking order based upon, I would suggest, an observation of reality is that we as individuals, we put ourselves first, we put our family second, which is, again, our family, our relatives, maybe our close friends, our close associates. We put them second, and then we put our community third. By community, I'm talking about the area, the city or town that we live in, the state that we live in, the country that we live in. And generally, the pecking order is in that order. And if we do that in that order, then we are putting on the value of our nation up at a high degree. The criticism of this is that, well, what about, you know, other people? What about the poor? What about, you know, people suffering all over the world? Well, I would suggest that by putting ourselves first, we are in a better position to help other people. And in fact, this country has helped other people because we've put ourselves first. We've created a society with such a level of freedom and all of the blessings that accompany freedom, the prosperity, the creativity, the inventiveness, that we find ourselves in a position where we can help other people and other nations in need, and do, and have done, and continue to do at an unprecedented level in history. So I would suggest that helping people and being, you know, involved in working with other people, that is part of putting yourself first. That is a natural part of the pecking order, but you have to put yourself first before you can do it. You know, the biblical nostrum is love your neighbor as yourself, right? I mean, which if you look at that idea, it's simply saying it's running under the assumption that you, of course, have to love yourself first. Then you can love your neighbor as yourself. You know what I mean? It's not, but it's like one thing comes before the other. So when Donald J. Trump talks about putting America first, he is talking about something that is natural to the human condition. He is talking about something that even animals understand and that plants even understand. It's part of life. And yet it becomes a moral prerequisite and more than simply a natural part of life when we put ourselves first in a moral context, which is that we are restrained by faith. And that includes the idea that there are greater responsibilities than simply living for the day. When we put ourselves into a system of law and order that protects and balances our right as individuals to put ourselves first and other people's rights also to put themselves first. In other words, my right to put myself first has to be checked by my neighbor's right to put himself first, right? I mean, I might think, well, I'm putting myself first by putting a dump in my backyard, okay? Because it makes it easier. Then I don't have to go to the, I don't have to schlep my garbage to the dump. Well, that's not necessarily in the interests of my neighbor. So, you know, their interests and their placement of themselves first is balanced by mine. And thus we have a compromise. And that is why we have a system of law and order. That is why we have a system that honors and protects private ownership and property ownership. Such ownership has to be balanced when you have many owners and they are competing. After all, competition also is a natural phenomena. So Donald Trump articulates that which is natural and that which is good when he says that he's going to put America first. And it is not something that can be taken for granted, because we have an establishment in this country, and there's always been a threat of this establishment going back in history that asks us to sacrifice ourselves for the good of someone else. Not put ourselves first and then help other people, but we are to sacrifice ourselves. We are not to be exceptional. We are not to be great. We're not going to make America great again, but we are to become a part of this sort of international amorphous entity, that we are to dumb ourselves down. That's their idea of putting yourself first. And that's been, in essence, the entire raison d'etre of recent decades, and certainly has come to fore during the administration of Barack Obama, who has clearly articulated this idea that we're not exceptional, that we're just part of a world system, that we're nothing more than a providence of the world, and that the result has been 8 years of dullness, putridity, lack of energy, lackluster development, and discouragement and negativity, actually. I mean, the guy is negative. So Americans want to be reminded again of what it is to be American, what it is to be a human being, what it is to be sovereign. And Donald Trump does that. And this is why this establishment, and that establishment, by the way, includes the majority of those whom we may call the top 1%. This is why they must destroy Trump. And they're trying to do it, believe me. And they will continue to try to do it every single day that he's in office. Let's take a look at what they've done so far. Immediately after his election, the day after his election, suddenly and spontaneously, street protests erupted, ugly street protests. We know that they were financed by George Soros, who is one of the most dangerous and evil people alive today. We know that he also, by the way, during the campaign, he financed these dirty tricks against Trump supporters by these brown shirts, you know, these kind of thugs who go in and try to create a disturbance, and then they would turn the tables and try to blame Donald Trump and his supporters for this. He was somewhat successful at that. That kind of muddied, that roughed Trump up a bit, you know, that somehow the people that support him are violent. That was the narrative that was being pushed. They figured that would destroy Trump. And also quietly, George Soros funded and organizations internationally, this one in particular called AVAZ, A-V-A-A-Z. I know this because I get their emails. Who tried to, for the first time in history, organize American expatriates to vote. In other words, American citizens who are living overseas, in Paris, primarily in Europe, London, Paris, Germany, to try to get them, organize them to vote. And apparently for them to vote in a U.S. election, there's, you know, it's not so easy. I mean, they have to go through various paperwork and whatnot. Well, they tried to make that easier, and they tried to organize them so they could stop Trump, basically. And they were campaigning openly for Hillary overseas. And these are people who, while they are American citizens for sure, and they certainly have the right to vote, they're not necessarily as invested in America because they don't live here. They possibly had lived in a foreign country their entire life or for many, many decades. When that didn't work, they launched the riots. And those riots had the same ugly whiff as did the Occupy Wall Street movement, the riots in 2014 supporting Hamas in their missile attack on the state of Israel. We could go back in history. We could take a look at the riots against the Iraq War. You know, the Ruckus Society riots in the 1990s. The riots against the World Trade Organization in Seattle. We could even go back to the 1960s. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some people who have legitimate beef and go out and want to, you know, support a cause. And we certainly have a right to do that. That's part of being American. I'm not talking about them. And I'm also not talking about the people who just went out to have fun. I think that has to be a big part of this. You know, you want to be one of the beautiful people, maybe pick up a date, go out on a date, go out with a bunch of friends and do some rioting. Why not? There's always that. I know this because as an Uber driver, I drove a few of those people. It's funny. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the organizers, the core group that's behind it. And in the case of the riots against Trump, that was two groups in particular, those being Black Lives Matter and Socialist Action. And in the case of Black Lives Matter, by the way, they are also funded by George Soros. And I would point out that the riots, which went on for, I'd say, about a week, maybe a week and a half, they started to peter out. And I think that the end of that was when Black Lives Matter tried to launch protests outside of white businesses on Black Friday after Thanksgiving, and that didn't work. Nobody showed up. And there was a riot of women against Trump that no one showed up, no media showed up. The whole thing fizzled. They are still talking about having massive million-person riots on Inauguration Day. And that may happen. That's happened in the past, by the way. I think that there was rioting when Nixon was inaugurated. So, I mean, that's nothing new. But I don't think they're going to get the kind of turnout that, they had hoped for. So that thing fizzles. So what do they do after that? The next line of assault was Jill Stein's recounts. Jill Stein wanted to recount the vote in three states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Accompanying that was rumblings about recounts in Florida, I think North Carolina, perhaps some other states that I might not have heard of. These were all states where the vote was close, but not by any means close enough to actually warrant a legitimate recount, I would suggest. In 1990, the recount in Florida, you might recall, between Bush and Gore, I think that was a legitimate recount. Al Gore was absolutely right to ask for a recount in that state. You had a state with approximately 6 million votes were cast, and only the difference between the two of them was about 1,000. That is so close that, of course, there would have to be a recount. So I don't quibble with that. Although, of course, Gore tried to corrupt it, and he tried to mess around by only recounting these certain counties, which were controlled by Democrat machines, and then they tried to do it behind closed doors, and they tried to count spoiled ballots, we may recall, you know, like the ones, you know, with the so-called chads and dimples. In other words, they were ballots that were damaged, so they couldn't be counted. So you had these Democrat Party hacks. They're holding them up to the lamp and saying, I think this one's for Gore. In other words, it was very corrupt. And Gore, you know, that's why Gore only asked for those recounts. And he kept re-recounting them. So it didn't take a look of honesty to it. Eventually, the Supreme Court had to step in and stop it. But in the case of Jill Stein, these elections weren't that close. I think that Wisconsin was about 10,000. I recall Michigan being about 12 or 13,000. And Pennsylvania was about 75,000 to 80,000 votes for Trump. So while they certainly were no landslide for Trump, and they certainly were no mandate, nevertheless, they were not so close that they would call for a legitimate recount. You know, Trump won the states. And as it turned out, Wisconsin did do a complete recount, and Trump picked up 131 votes. Pennsylvania, which only has paper ballots, they did a recount in two counties, the two most Democratic counties, those being in Philadelphia, one in Pittsburgh. And the result was that Hillary Clinton picked up 5 votes. So the state of Pennsylvania realized that there was no massive voter fraud or no reason to have a statewide count. So they didn't go forward.